People who practice are much more successful than people who just wing it. And unfortunately, in the chronics community, a lot of people wing it. They just say, oh, I signed up. I throw a lot of money at the problem, and I just hope for the best. The reality is planning. People who plan versus people who don't plan.
Greetings, dear listeners. I'm your host, Max Marty.
And I'm your host, Daniel Walters.
And you're listening to the one and only Cryonics Underground podcast. Okay, on today's episode, we're speaking with Dennis Kowalski. Dennis is the president of the Cryonics Institute. Alongside being a paramedic and a firefighter, Dennis brings an enormous amount of practical real-world experience to cryonics and to the preservation process, and we're very fortunate to be able to hear him share that experience with us today. You might also notice a few audio issues in the beginning of the podcast, but if you bear with us, they will get better, and the stuff we talk about today could very well be pivotal in a good cryopreservation in the future. Finally, we're doing something a little bit different with this episode. We are going to break it into two parts, and we are starting today with part one. Part two will be forthcoming soon. So please let us know if you like this format or if you want the longer full episode formats. Now, without further ado, we bring you the great Dennis Kowalski. I'm joined today by Dennis Kowalski. Dennis, thank you for coming on Cryonics Underground with Daniel and I.
Thanks for having me.
Dennis is the president of the Cryonics Institute. I understand you guys are over in Detroit, and you guys are one of the big names in cryonics, perhaps arguably the biggest name in cryonics. You've been around for a very long time, and I'm very happy to get a chance to talk to you today, not just about the Cryonics Institute, but about you and how you got interested in this, and you know what your passions are around this, and what the future of cryonics in general and the Cryonics Institute is going to be. So thanks again for coming on.
You're welcome.
I want to start first with a little bit of a history. Can you lay out the groundwork of how the Cryonics Institute got started, when it got started, who were the names, and then help us catch up a little bit with some of that early stuff so we can get up to speed with where you are now.
Sure. So the idea of pulling people down or preserving them for future reanimation has actually been around for forever. I mean, it goes back to the Egyptians and the pyramids, and it's been in popular fiction and short stories and novels forever. But it wasn't until the 1960s that a particular physics professor in the Detroit area, Professor Robert Ettinger, decided to look at it from a scientific standpoint and apply his critique to it. And he wanted to see, is this possible? What would actually happen if you froze biological tissues? Could you freeze a human? You know, does this make sense from a scientific point of view, not from a literary point of view? And he was inspired actually from a short story it was Isaac Asimov. It was a story about a gentleman who got frozen and in space, and he was picked up by, you know, many, many, many millennia later by some aliens who resurrected him into some kind of a robot body, and then that's what inspired him, amongst other things. He was also a World War II hero, and he was in the Battle of Bulge, and he lost, or he would have lost his legs from an artillery explosion below the knees if it wasn't for the newest, latest science of that time, which was bone grafting. So that also impacted him greatly, that, wow, you know, this was impossible just 10, 15 years ago, and now they can save my legs, you know? So that, you know, was some of the early catalysts for him to look into cryonics. And then he eventually wrote a book. So people were bantering around the ideal of freezing people for, like I said, many, many millennia. But he wrote a book, and that book went to publication. Was the prospect for did the prospect of immortality or for immortality? I forgot. I get messed up on that. But it went on to become a bestseller and was published all over the world. And he kind of got famous for that, for bringing up the idea. And he thought, okay, now my work is done. Kranix is, I've done my part. I've introduced it, and people far smarter than me and more connected than me to me are going to start applying Kranix as a last resort of medical emergency treatment. And of course that didn't happen. And so a lot of people were inspired by that book. One of the first couple pioneers in the movement started freezing people themselves, and with some, they really didn't have all their P's and Q's down. They, you know, I don't know if you know about the Chatsworth incident, where I think it was the Cryonic Society of California froze some people, and they were, it was kind of like a pay as you go system, and that didn't work out so good. You know, everyone talks about, you know, how your uncle might leave you $1 million after he dies. Imagine your uncle leaving you this perpetual bill that you have to pay. So that didn't work out. But that, you know, that kind of information helped educate the future Kranix organizations about what not to do. So, you know, we realized that we needed to collect enough money, at least up front, so that we could put that into like an endowment or some type of investment, so the interest would pay for the perpetual storage, upkeep, and overhead. He decided, you know what, if this is going to be done right, I have to do it. So prior to the Kranix Institute, there was an organization called the Immortalist Society. It was kind of like the philosophical wing of Kranix. And eventually, the Kranix Institute itself was formed in 1976. First patient being Robert Ettinger's mother, actually. And slowly but surely, through donations, investment, volunteer work, it grew into a multi-million dollar organization, and we are where we're at today. Now, the organization is run by its members. It's unique in the fact that you become a member and you are allowed to vote for your own directors. There's 12 directors. Those directors vote internally for the officers who actually run the organization. So everyone who's running the Kranix Institute is actually a signed up member with a vested interest in the process. And that's by design, because we didn't want someone coming in and running the place who doesn't believe in Kranix. We also have a strict set of bylaws that adheres to our mission of taking people in, kind of providing the ambulance ride to the future. We're not the hospital of the future. We don't pretend to be, but we are that ambulance ride that gets people there. And sometimes there can be mission creep, you know, when you try to do too much. And we try to stay kind of humble and to our beginnings. And one of the things we've done is our initial price when we started was $28,000, funded mostly, usually by life insurance policies, which means it's not really that expensive when you take that into context. And we've never raised our prices over all the years since 1976. We've actually gone down, adjusted for inflation. And that's because of economies of scale. You know, if we had one person in a building that costs $1 million.
$28,000.
That $28,000,
what is it?
But
what
if you have like
pay for, or how does that, how is that broken
like
down?
We have now, that cost can be split up and deferred, so we don't have to duplicate efforts as much. So that's kind of where we're at now.
And that $28,000, what does it pay for, or how is that broken down into the subcomponents?
So that's the basic price, that $28,000. Usually less than $8,000 ends up going to the actual process of bringing you down to liquid nitrogen temperatures and paying for transportation and funerals, directors and so forth. And, you know, $20,000 or more goes to the investment for the long-term storage of that person. So it's kind of like our endowment. And, you know, and then eventually when hopefully we can revive people, all of that money, no matter how large that's grown to be, will actually pay for the reanimation and reintegration of that person into society, because then the mission changes from storage to, or transport to the future, to let's get things done.
So let's say I'm living in, I don't know, Oklahoma, and I'm signed up with you guys, and I have $28,000. Maybe I'm funding it through life insurance or some other way, and I know the end is near. I'm going to be I'm going to be departing this mortal coil in a matter of weeks or months. The 28,000, does that pay for someone to be by my bedside and be able to do the necessary things to start lowering my body temperature down to just above? My understanding is, you lower it just above freezing, and then you transport the body over to you guys, and then you guys continue the process of going below freezing when you put in the vitrification fluid and you do the perfusion. And is that how it works with you guys? You know, when, or do I contract separately for someone to come and be at my bedside, you know, in Oklahoma, and then transport me over to Michigan? Or how does that work?
So what you're referring to is standby, and some organizations build standby into their price. So in that regard, you're paying for the long-term storage and you're paying for the standby. Our approach to that has been, we leave that up to you and your individual situation, wherever you may be in the world, in the country, because for obvious reasons, logistical reasons, you may not be able to use a centralized standby that's on the other side of the country or in another country. And it may be that money better spent through a local team who is maybe not as well trained as a centralized team that's far away might actually be better for you. So I use this analogy, and it's a lot of times in Chronics we try to reinvent the wheel, and a lot of things have been done already, and we just have to look out there and see how is this being done in conventional emergency medicine? Why is it being done that way? And how can we implement that to Chronics? That's what I like to do. And that's because of my background as a paramedic in emergency services. So when it comes to the ultimate storage of a Chronics patient, a centralized approach seems to make sense, because it's, if you had all these different, if you have too many, like, remember I said, I don't want there to be just one monopoly, but if you had a couple Chronics organizations competing, you have kind of a healthy competition. If you have too many Chronics organizations, you start losing your scales of economy. So, you know, if you have 100 people in one building, that's going to be more cost effective than 10 people in 10 buildings. Okay. So centralization starts to make sense when you're actually storing the patients. When it comes to standby, it's the exact opposite. It's actually decentralization makes sense. And if you think about it, it's like a centralized hospital in a big city, right? You're not going to have hospitals at every corner all over the country in all the remotest areas. You can't afford to have major hospitals. But what you can afford to have is a moderate degree of training and ambulance services all over the place that bring you to that central hospital through transportation. And that's what we have in conventional emergency medicine. So, you know, if right now we're having this conversation, if you would fall over and have a heart attack, you know, obviously it would be best if the world's best cardiac surgeons and equipment were right there, right by you, right? But if they were, let's say, 10 hours away, but your neighbor, you know, who happens to be a plumber, but he knows a little bit of CPR from maybe watching it on television, he can save your life. Those best doctors 10 hours away, they're not going to do any good to you. So what I, you know, advise people to do is, if you have the money, if you have plenty of money and plenty of resources, sign up for both. Sign up for a centralized, excellent standby service like suspended animation or ICE or something like that, who can come to your bedside if there's enough advance notice. Maybe you have a terminal illness. But also, and even possibly more importantly, have something local to your area that you've worked out with the funeral director. Because the funeral directors are everywhere. They're already decentralized, and you already have to use them no matter what. I know a lot of chronicists cringe at that because, we're admitting that we're dead because we're dealing with funeral directors. But the law is really clear. You have to use funeral directors to ship people across state lines. So you have to use these people anyhow. You have to pay them anyhow. If you can get them to do what we want, which is transporting you icy cold temperatures and maybe doing a little bit of CPR with some medications, that's a benefit. And I've been able to do that. We've been able to do that many times. Not always. Not all funeral directors. And that's why you try to plan ahead of time. You feel out these funeral directors, find out how far they're willing to go or not go, and And if they're not willing to help, then you move to another funeral director. And if you've got time to pre-plan, of course, the best option is to get yourself to the cryonics organization before you even deanimate. So if you know you've got end-stage cancer, you know, moving to the Detroit area, actually the Cryonics Institute's in Clinton Township. It's a suburb of Detroit, about a half hour out. And I know people get worried with the civil unrest and riots and protests and everything like that, but we're in a very safe area, but we're still close enough to the highway system and airports so we can get bodies in that way. But anyways, it's smart to get close to the Cryonics organization just from a purely logistical sense. Is it a perfect system? No. Conventional emergency medicine is not a perfect system. You know, if you're far, far in a remote rural area and you have a heart attack, you're not going to be in as good of a situation as if you're close to a major metropolitan area with all the hospital services that are in that area. So it's just the same thing. It's no different with cryonics. It's just kind of applying common sense to the equation.
Now, Dennis, is there any reason for the Cryonics Institute location? Was it just arbitrary? Did it just happen that's where it started, or was there some reasoning behind why it's located where it is?
Well, it's kind of in the center of the United States between the East and West Coast. The Detroit area is a major metropolitan, you know, has the major metropolitan resources, a major airport, hospice centers. We have very little problems as far as wildland fires or hurricanes or earthquakes and that kind of stuff. I mean, the consideration did go into it, but, you know, and part of it's the residential roots of Edinger, who was a professor in that Detroit area ahead of time, but he did look at all different areas, and he decided he was already in a pretty decent area in the United States, and so it worked out to our advantage.
And in terms of protection and location, you guys are an above-ground location?
We are.
And is there any downside to that? Is it safer underground? Is that just a matter of it being too expensive, or mm-hmm. What kind of consideration was put into that?
All of the above. You know, above ground, then you got to worry about tornadoes, which can strike pretty much anywhere in the United States. Below ground, then you got flooding issues. For the most part, I would say below ground is probably better, but it's certainly much more expensive. And, you know, if we all had our druthers, you know, we'd be in Cheyenne Mountain. But, you know, we can't afford that. That certainly would make more sense. But, you know, you got to make do with the resources you have as well.
Maybe in the future, as you know, the excitement over cryonics and the industry grows as a whole, maybe there would be an ability to grow into Cheyenne Mountain, as you put it.
Yeah. So it would be, you know, I'd love to see something like that, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
What about talking about Michigan a little bit, what about the legal and political situation in Michigan? Has it been favorable since the 70s? Has it changed over time? And where do you see it going in the future?
Well, we've been pretty fortunate in that two of our directors are lawyers, and also the son of Robert Edinger, David Edinger, does a lot of legal work for us, and he's a pretty prominent attorney. And so there's been virtually no legal threats against us. We're pretty safe, and we're very extremely defensive in that arena because, let's face it, you know, we could have 10 times the money we have now, and one good or bad lawsuit could put us, render us out of existence. So, in fact, some might say that the more money you have, the juicier a target you are for legal action.
Yeah, I know there was some situation where you were being challenged as being considered a cemetery. Could you tell us more about that?
So, in that circumstance, from my understanding, that was when the media was... there was a lot of negative publicity in the media related to the Ted Williams case. And that spilled over to a local politician who was just looking to, I don't know, make a name for himself or, you know, champion getting rid of those wacky cryonics guys. And he decided he was going to try to do something to kind of push us or regulate us out of existence. And very quickly, our legal team swung into action and defended. And part of the defense was the existing legal framework of a cemetery worked very well too, because we met all the requirements already for that. So we were able to just use that legal umbrella, and it worked for us and protected us. And that has since reverted back to a non-cemetery status. But it was, I think, a smart thing to do to preserve our status so we'd keep operating.
Dennis, so you told us a little bit about the history of CI corporately. Could you tell us a little bit about the current standard of care for a person who's undergoing vitrification, and how did that practice start, and how has it changed over the years from its inception?
So in the beginning, just like the other all other organizations, the first people cryopreserved were considered what's called a straight freeze. So basically, they went right into liquid nitrogen. And, the idea was that in the end, you know, the damage that is done by ice crystallization between the cells is worth it, because at least you're saving the bulk of the structure, the DNA, and the bulk of the structure that makes up a person's mind, so that some future technology, who knows, nanotechnology could revive you and piece you back together. Later on, people in the cryobiology community suggested that we use a form of vitrification where in between the cells, instead of ice crystals forming, everything slows down and becomes like a glassy state, like a glass. And that requires agents that are referred to as biological antifreezes, or vitrification agents, and there's a drawback to that. There's pros and cons to that. The con is that at warmer temperatures, these chemicals are toxic. But the plus to that is that you don't have quite as much damage as you would have had the person been a straight freeze. And kind of universally, the cryonics community decided that it was worth it. The toxicity, if we could minimize the structural damage, because the thought is that that's really who you are, is the connections and all the synapses and nerve and connectome of your brain, and that's what we need to preserve. So we thought, that's the way to go. So now research is going into different ways of vitrifying people that would involve less toxicity or just better ways of cutting down on any thermal fracturing or ice crystallization.
Wait, when you say toxicity, could you explain what do you mean by that? How it's toxic to the cells or the chemical makeup of our bodies?
Well, you're kind of getting me to step outside my lane there, because I'm not a scientist. I've worked in emergency medicine, but I'm not a chemist, and I'm not certainly not a cryobiologist. But the way it's been explained to me in layman's terms is that one of the main components of vitrification materials is ethylene glycol, which is a antifreeze, and we all know at warm temperatures, the reactivity of molecules to other molecules increases with temperature, because what is temperature but faster moving molecules and faster reaction time? So if we can slow down the reaction time, even though something might be considered poisonous at warmer temperatures, it's not poisonous at colder temperatures. And these agents, they remain liquid even below ice water freezing temperatures. So they're not solid at, below freezing. They're liquid. And they can be perfused into the tissues with kind of like a heart-lung bypass machine. We access your vascular system, and hoping that your vascular system is intact enough to use the vitrification agents, then it perfuses. It goes down all the big veins and arteries down to the smaller capillaries and pushes into the tissues. And that's where it protects the tissues from thermal cracking and ice ice crystallization. And I mean, forgive me if I'm murdering this scientifically. Someone else, there's people like Greg Fay or other people that could talk to the subject much more intelligently and articulately than I. But this is the way I understand it. And so there's a trade-off. The trade-off is, you take the vitrification agents with their minimal, try to be quick about it. Try to be make sure everything's cold, and hopefully we're doing less harm. It's like the you know the old I can't think of it. The medical do no harm. That's our goal to try to minimize the damage.
And Dennis, is there any method you guys have of verifying that the vitrification solution has actually perfused, everywhere you wanted it? Is there a way to know that, or is it kind of a hope for the best? How does that work?
Well, you know, the real way to find out if you've got good vitrification is to actually, kind of do an autopsy, or if we had future techniques that could go in there and see. But the problem with that is like a lot of people have suggested imaging techniques, MRI type of stuff. The problem is, what are you going to do with that? The real reason, not everyone just gets MRIs or CT scans just for everything or for their health. For one, it's expensive and the resources are not there. I mean, we're talking about regular medicine. The reason for getting those things is so you can intervene and do something about it. So if someone's got, for instance, a stroke or a clot in their heart, and we can go in there and we can fix it, a cardiac surgeon or a brain surgeon, we want to image it, find out where it is and find out what the damage is, what we can do. With Chronix, there's no brain surgeons on staff, and we're not going to be able to do anything, even if we find out that we didn't get the best vitrification. So all we can do is do the best we can, attempt to vitrify, and in many cases, we can't vitrify. I mean, if the person's got a compromised vascular system in the first place, even getting them there quickly to the cryonics organization with the best standard of standby care, it's not going to matter. So, we've kind of opted to leave out the imaging, and, we look at other things, more practical things like, what kind of return do we have? From the flow of vitrification agent coming out on the other end. We look at, do we have the desirable dehydration, or do we have edema, which shows that the vascular system is compromised, and we stop. If we see that there's any compromise, we stop immediately, and there's nothing we can do about it. We're not going to do surgery on the patients. So we do the best we can with what we have, and try to be practical about it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and what kind of patients or what kind of conditions would have compromised, I guess, vascularity? Are there any? Are there specific types of cases that are harder than others, or does it have to do with how old you are, or what disease you're suffering from?
So number one is obviously speed and how fast your cool down. So the number one thing that's going to cause for a bad suspension is if you're not found right away. Let's go backwards. If you didn't plan well, if you didn't take the time to talk things over with your family, get them on your side, get your family and friends and local funeral director on your side. You want to set up, have these conversations ahead of time so that when something goes wrong, you're prepared. It's like running fire drills, we're going to, meet at this tree outside the house, and we're going to do this, we're going to do that. People who practice are much more successful than people who just wing it. And unfortunately, in the cryonics community, a lot of people wing it. They just say, I signed up. I throw a lot of money at the problem, and I just hope for the best. The reality is planning. You have to look at all the cases at all the organizations, and you'll find the same common thread of people who plan versus people who don't plan. People who notify the cryonics organization fast versus people who get around to it later because the family's, grieving and they're not thinking cryonics. And then enters in other things like bureaucracy and with the hospital or with transportation and so forth. And if there's any slowdown in getting you cooled and or shipped out to us, that's where the problems come in. And that's where the vascular system breaks down right away. And if you don't get to us cold within, certainly within a 48-hour period, we don't even attempt vitrification. It's just a straight freeze because we've got no success beyond that point. Okay. So, that's number one. And I have to say that that's number one. The main reason why vascular, of course, there's other reasons too. The older you are, if you're a diabetic, if you've got heart disease, if you've got arterial sclerosis, anything like that, high blood pressure, all those things are going to weaken your vascular system, and it's going to compromise things. But number one is beyond that is just not calling us quick enough and getting you cooled down quick enough. Because you could be 20 years old and in the best health, and time is our enemy. You got to go fast, just like in conventional medicine. If someone waits to call 911 and doesn't begin CPR right away, or takes their time, the chances of bringing someone back, it's pretty slim. But if you get right on that chest and you start pumping right away and you start breathing and you call 911 and because you've practiced, because you've taken maybe some American Heart Association CPR classes. Even a lay people can save your neighbor, save your spouse and loved ones. Same thing applies to us. Again, we're not reinventing the wheel. Lay people can do a lot, a lot more than just figuring, the best doctors in the world or this. I'm just going to throw money at this. It's not the way it works with chronics. You got to roll up your sleeves and do some work and do some research and put your nose to the grindstone.
Could you give us if there was a best case scenario for how, one could be cryopreserved, just something for people who are signed up to aspire to have a baseline of the way you would ideally want it to happen. What would that look like?
So I'll give you two examples. Robert Ettinger himself, he had practiced what he preached. He realized that, he's getting up there in age and he was in his 90s when he passed. And, he knew, I'm not going to be around forever. I better start making sure not only did I have the storage facility in place for cryonics, but I better have some idea of how I'm going to get from where I'm at now when I deanimate to the cryonics facility. Well, he was already close to the cryonics facility. That's key. His family and friends obviously knew his wishes. I mean, that was a big part of his life. And so everybody was on board and everyone knew, first thing we're going to do is we're going to start calling these numbers that are pre-programmed into our phone. And we've got this equipment and we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And pretty simple solution. I mean, we didn't throw a lot of money at that problem. But what we did is we threw some money at it. Robert's son, David, hired nurses' aides to, hourly to be at his bedside when he was really sick so that they knew immediately when he was going to pass. And they also were trained in imminent signs of death, which you see after a while, maybe someone, their breathing patterns change, they lose consciousness first and they get these, like a fish out of water, breathing patterns. You kind of know time is getting short. So from that point on, we go into letting everyone know, let's get all the equipment right bedside, or maybe the equipment is already bedside. In the case of Robert Ettinger, we were able to get there quickly. We talked to the hospice center, and they pronounced quickly because they understood that this was the patient's last wish. His final wishes were to be cryopreserved. They understood that. They didn't have to understand, cryonics entirely. They didn't have to be on board with it. They just had to be on board with, hey, what we're doing here is legal, it's ethical. They're paying us, we're being compensated fairly. And, let's honor this man's wishes and his family's wishes. It doesn't hurt anything. So by preparing the hospice center ahead of time, by preparing everyone in advance, literally like seconds after he went into cardiac arrest, he was pronounced. And then immediately he was put in an ice bath. We started CPR while he was in the ice bath. And, he got a excellent, excellent treatment. Another situation that comes to mind is a person who's public about his deanimation, Aaron Winborn. He was on a ventilator, and he had advanced Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, and he wanted to be cryopreserved. So we knew when he was going to die. We're not talking about euthanasia or anything like that. We're talking about a person refusing the ventilator. So he decided, he talked to his doctors, and he decided, I'm going to refuse this ventilator. I'm going to refuse treatment, which is legal everywhere in the world. It's not as such a gray area as a doctor, let's say, giving you something that would end your life, like a euthanasia. But this is, anyone can refuse treatment. So he refused the ventilator, and he asked the doctor to make him comfortable ahead of time, you know, pain medications and so forth, so he wouldn't suffer. And the doctor was right there to pronounce legal death, as was I and my equipment. And I had pre-planned and talked to the funeral team ahead of time. Perfect, perfect suspension. I mean, it couldn't go any better because it was quick. He was in the ice, and it was just a lot of good planning. Everyone understood what to do. And now the funeral team, they had no experience in doing CPR on a cadaver, as they thought. And all they needed was me there as like a team leader to say, okay, we got to do this, we got to do that, we got to do this, we got to do that. And everything went quick. And when we got him to the cryonics facility, perfusion was perfect, you know. So, you know, but not everyone dies, you know, perfectly, as far as, you know, you could be out hiking in the woods alone, you know, and with nobody. So you got to think of those situations. But you know what? That's how it is with conventional emergency medicine. You know, you could die alone there too, and you CPR could have saved you. But guess what? Nobody's.
What
there.
Years were, so maybe, were these two cases, Dennis?
Oh, geez, I would say in the last 5-10 years.
Oh, okay, okay.
The last 5 years for Aaron, and the last 10 years, I believe, for Robert Ettinger.
What's seeming really clear to me, and I hope the listeners and those who are either signed up for chronics or thinking about signing up for chronics, is that it's not a set it and forget it kind of situation. Now, hopefully at some point in the future, when or if chronics becomes the standard of care, it may be, you know, a little bit easier, and the people around you will kind of have it covered, just like, you know, certain standard of care are covered now. But yeah, it seems clear that's the way to do it. You really have to put some effort into it and kind of get involved, which is probably not pleasant news to everybody's ears. You know, a lot of people just want to feel like they've checked it off their list and then be done with it. But unfortunately, I guess it just doesn't work that way as of yet.
You're right, and you know, it's the brutal truth of the matter. And I would argue, even in conventional medicine, even there, we're not at a situation where you can just forget things. I mean, if your loved ones or spouse or friends understand basic CPR, wow, that's so huge, versus not understanding it and just calling 911 and hoping for the best. I mean, there was a huge, huge outcome difference. I believe Seattle is like number one in the world for cardiac arrest resuscitation, because they're so aggressive at pushing in the public school system CPR and CPR training. So just about everyone on every street corner knows CPR in the city of Seattle. So, and Milwaukee's not too far behind where I operated as a paramedic and firefighter for many years. So, yeah, if you have that level of training, you're going to have a better chance. And that's conventional medicine. So it really, it's not a whole lot different for us. We're kind of like just like conventional medicine, CPR, just add ice.
And Dennis, how many of the number of members, patients that you receive on a yearly basis, if you're at liberty to say, how many of them come in a pretty good condition, you know, ready for perfusion and all that? How many of them come in, you know, what you would say is less than ideal, less than ideal conditions?
Oh, boy, that's hard to say, because it's all over the board, you know. You know, I've looked back at all the case reports everywhere, and it's the one common thread that I find is that I would say half, you know, half go good, half go bad. But I wouldn't say that the bad ones are complete losses either. They're just not as good. And depending on what's needed for the future, what technology can revive people, if some sort of a molecular nanotechnology, you know, there's got to be, in my mind anyhow, logically, there has to be a point of no return where there's complete information loss. If there's complete information loss, then you might as well be saving a tiny piece of tissue, and because you're getting a clone, right? It'll be a healthy person that looks just like you in every possible way. But if there's no information left over from your mind, then that's all you're saving. So some people might say, well, that's a good thing. That's better than nothing, right? So that's not a complete loss. But I don't know if you guys are like me. I don't want just a clone of me brought back to the future. I want me, my mind. And so, you know, just like a person who, you know, goes into cardiac arrest, how long you're in cardiac arrest, even if you do recover, is going to play out into your quality of life, you know, after you are revived, whether you have brain damage or something like that. Now, my thought is with the future technology that can actually bring you back, brain damage wouldn't be permanent. So, but information loss would be. So just like a stroke victim who maybe doesn't know how to walk, but, and maybe has speech impediments, but they're still happy to be alive, can relearn, right, how to walk, maybe not as good, or can relearn speech. I would imagine that the cryonics patient who loses some information will be able to relearn and pick up things. And even, and with an advanced molecular nanotechnology, they should be able to recover and walk completely, right? And be able to live a life completely. But there's going to be certain memories that are lost, you know, depending on the circumstance, depending on how long it's been that before you got cool down, before you got shipped out to us and so forth. So isn't the ultimate goal to minimize that damage or that information loss? That's what we're doing. That's our $1 million goal. And can I quantify it exactly? No, nobody knows exactly, you know, how everything is encoded into the brain. But we do know, just a sense of logic, that faster, cooler is better, you know, and you can do things, you know, like take care of yourself. The longer you live, you know, by dieting and eating right and exercising, then maybe new technologies, new vitrification solutions will come out with less toxicity. So you'll be better off. So all of these things kind of come into play. To me, it's the big idea is not how many people before the year 2020 had perfect suspensions or not. The big thing to learn is what can we do to improve? What can we learn? And we can learn that the people who had good suspensions planned, right? And the people who didn't plan kind of rolled the dice. And every once in a while, you get lucky. Some people who rolled the dice got lucky and did well. But there's going to be situations you can plan and do everything right. Things aren't going to go good. You know, you could get hit by a bus tomorrow, and you get squashed. You know, your brain could be squashed. You know, cryonics might not do you much good under the right circumstance or the wrong circumstances. But all we can do is, you know, do the best we can, you know, fight the good fight.
Now, speaking of information loss, a question I've been asked a few times in regards to diseases of old age, such as Alzheimer's or dementia, is do they know whether the information, you know, that causes that memory loss is being completely eradicated, or is it just there but unable to be accessed? Is there a standard way to know the difference between those two?
Well, if there is, I don't know. I mean, I'm no brain surgeon, but, you know, and I don't even think the brain surgeons know entirely, you know, because usually when you have a disease that, you know, kind of erodes your mind, if you will, and it's non-curable, you know, to current society, you know, the current society, it's like, what does it matter? You know, whether grandpa is still there but locked into his brain versus is grandpa just a vegetable, from the outside world, the interaction world, you know, it's almost as if, you know, you wish that they're not being tortured or suffering and having a full mind, I guess. But from a cryonics standpoint, yeah, we want to hope that maybe that information is still there, but just fractured off. And my logical guess is at first, yes, that information is still there, but fractured off. And I tend to look at it like the way I think the diseases unfold. The analogy I might use is think of something that's information rich, like a photograph of maybe the Mona Lisa painting, you know, and if you coarsely tear it down the middle a couple times, well, certainly now it's not functioning in the same capacity, but you could still, you know, tape it back together and make out that it was the Mona Lisa. Or if it was a book, we could still read the pages and understand the story. And you keep ripping those pages or shredding them into smaller and smaller pieces, a higher level of damage. You know, in theory, you could still put all those pieces back together as long as you can infer the information from one piece to the next. It's a much harder problem now because it's more puzzle pieces to go together. But eventually, you know, you burn those pieces and stir the ashes or, you know, dissolve them in acid. You're just not going to get the information. And I think most diseases, you know, this is just my layperson analogy, I think they start off coarse to fine, and then eventually the information is dissolved. And again, it's about how quickly we can capture and stop the damage, and maybe, you know, preserve the fidelity of what your mind is, you know, all the components. And that's what we're trying to do with Cryonics, you know, just stop the damage, stop the information log. Oh. And that's why, so, you know, I've talked about, and we're thinking, you know, if I have some sort of a disease that's debilitating, that's going to maybe wipe out my brain before I die, you know, maybe euthanasia would be a preferable situation. That's we're an easy target. So I try to avoid those things. But certainly there is, you know, places in the world where it is legal to, you know, euthanize oneself. And we would hope that if someone did something like that, they were, you know, broadcasting it or making a giant scene out of it and trying to draw attention to themselves. And as long as things were done legally, morally, ethically, you know, I personally would be very against someone who tried to euthanize themselves because of depression or anxiety, as opposed to a terminal brain cancer or something like that. So, because we certainly don't want to be known in Cryonics as encouraging something that could cause huge legal ramifications or ethical violations that would put us out of existence.
Yeah, I agree. As such a kind of small arena, it's definitely better to kind of straddle everywhere, from, you know, politics to religion, kind of not wade into debates that we don't need to be in.
Well, yeah, you know, and think about it. I mean, you go to the hospital for maybe a heart transplant, they're not going to say, you know, are you Republican or Democrat? Or, you know, they don't care. They're not going to say, are you atheist or are you Christian? It's, you know, basically, do you want a heart transplant or not? Now, some of your ideological beliefs or religion might drive whether you get the heart transplant or not, but that's between you and your decision-making process. It's not for the hospital to ask. And if we want to try to put ourselves out there as some form of modern medicine or cutting edge medicine, we have to act accordingly and responsibly.
Now, speaking of the types of people, could you tell us a little bit about the demographics of the Cryonics Institute? What are the total numbers of living members and the total numbers of preserved patients? And could you give us a little bit of data, you know, age, gender, geographical locations for those members and preserved patients?
Yeah, I would say that's the question was, how many people are cryopreserved? Approximately 200, approximately 2,500 signed up. A similar, maybe 200 pets or so preserved with us. Several hundred tissue samples. People have maybe not been able to fully pay for the preservation of a pet, but they saved some DNA, so maybe in hopes that in the future they could clone the pet or a family member or take some of that information for future analysis, whether it's from a deceased family member or so forth. So we have tissue samples. We have, you know, like for the DNA, we have pets, humans, and many people signed up. And that number seems to be growing exponentially, actually, but slowly.
And is there a age and gender skew for people signing up and people preserved?
I can tell you there's more men than women, but we have many women, you know, signed up. There's, you know, politically across the spectrum, religiously across the spectrum, we tend to have more agnostic people, or maybe a-religious, not necessarily atheists, but we do have our fair share of atheistic. But, we, you know, again, we have people who are fundamentalists in all the major religions as well. So it kind of mirrors modern medicine in that fashion. But one common thread that you tend to see is everyone in Cryonics tends to have some desire or interest in science fiction and or optimism for the future, which kind of stands to reason. Why would you sign up if you're purely dystopian or you don't think anything is going to work out for us in the future?
Are there a lot of people who happen to be signed up because their spouses are signed up, or because, for example, kids who are signed up because their parents signed them up?
Well, I think that would apply to my family. You know, my wife and three boys are signed up because of me. But we've actually had the ideological discussion, and you know, they agree with Cryonics. My wife thinks it's, you know, makes sense, and it's certainly better than nothing or getting cremated or buried. But her, statistically, she thinks there's a lower probability of it working than I do, for instance. But she still thinks that's better than nothing. And my kids don't really have a huge passion about it. I guess it's because, you know, they don't think that, they think that they got a long time to go yet, you know. And of course, everyone thinks that, that they're not going to die tomorrow, but you know, the bus could hit you tomorrow, so you never know. But I think everyone is on board, but I don't know if they would have signed up themselves if it wasn't for me signing up originally.
Are there, does the Cryonics Institute do marketing in the traditional way in which we would, you know, imagine marketing? Like, how do you guys do outreach, or do you guys leave that to, you know, all of the rest of the cryonics industry as a whole, and then you just sort of receive the interest and move people on from there?
So my thought is that spending too much on marketing is kind of a waste of time and waste of money. I mean, we've got limited resources, so I think people, they're going to want to come to Cryonics because they're already optimistic and they have that desire to know the future, whether it's through science fiction or deep scientific you know, videos and books and what they read, and as the news about, you know, different scientific breakthroughs come, you know, like whether it's CRISPR-Cas9 or biological, you know, molecular nanotechnology or 3D biological printing or all these different things that you see kind of happening, of artificial intelligence, for instance. Together, the culmination of that's going to drive people towards Cryonics. After that, then I think if the Cryonics organizations are doing their job and being logical, looking sharp, being sharp, and being ready for the questions that people have to ask, and you know, giving honest answers, I think people are going to come to us. But to sit there and go out and, you know, it's just something you can't sell to the general public like you can, you know, windows or siding or something like that. You know, you can't market it like that. And people have tried. Hollywood does movies sometimes, you know, and videos on the internet. I think those things kind of help, but it's more effort than it is throwing money at the issue. You know, whether someone writes a book or if it reaches into the public psyche enough, it'll become popular. But for the most part, you know, it's kind of disheartening to know that more people have joined cults and committed suicide than have signed up for Cryonics based on their cult beliefs, you know, or done other crazy things. But those cults are promising people all kinds of things that we would never promise. You know, we're brutally honest. We say, well, you know, Cryonics might not, you know, and that's the most honest thing you can say. And, you know, if you start promising things that, you know, through, and that's the problem with marketing. Marketing often promises things that they overslick things up, you know, and it's a bait and switch. And I think that's something we really want to stay away from when it comes to Cryonics.
Yeah, I feel like regardless, you can't promise that Cryonics will work, but alternatively, you can promise that death will be certain otherwise. So really, insofar as I'm concerned, and I know a lot of other chronicists are concerned, you know, it's really your only option at the moment. A chance at it is, you know, infinitely better than certain death. And then, you know, I guess that depends on whether you believe in an afterlife and such. But if you don't, then, you know, where else do you have to turn, really?
Well, and even if you did believe in an afterlife, you know, you could say, well, then why go to the hospital? If you've got cancer, why seek cancer treatment or get that heart transplant? Because you can just, you know, pray and meet your maker and go to, you know, receive your holy rewards or whatever. Certainly a lot of people who are religious still believe in going to the doctor. And if you, you know, extrapolate, we're cutting edge medicine. We're like the extension of the emergency cardiac arrest. Instead of giving up after a half hour, we're saying, well, let's give it another 300-400 years and see if we've advanced than where we are today.
Okay, that was part one of our two-parter with Dennis Kowalski. The second part is coming up shortly. Thank you all for bearing with us through some of these strange audio issues that we were having, especially early on. Learning this podcasting stuff and editing and everything is a work in progress, but these conversations are incredibly important, and so we're going to be getting better at it over time. As you heard today, planning is going to make or break the quality of your cryopreservation, which may determine whether or not you ever get a chance to wake up. So this is perhaps one of the most important conversations we've had to date. Now, the second conversation, we're going to touch upon things like the big question of Alcor versus CI, and more about Dennis and how he came to cryonics, along with some vivid real-world examples of what happens to cryonicists who do not heed Dennis's advice and don't prepare properly. So, keep an eye out for our next episode, where Daniel and I will bring you Dennis Kowalski, Part 2.